Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
There's gold fever on the streets of St. Paul.
$1 billion con.
We finally hit the big time.
A jackpot.
There was no sign of anything that was amiss.
Everybody wanted to get rich.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's too good to be true. It's too good to be true.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 26th of May, these are our main stories. Ukraine's President Zelensky has condemned a deadly air attack on a crowded superstore in the city of Kharkiv as an act of Russian madness. More than 20 people have been killed in a fire at an entertainment complex in the Indian state of Gujarat. South Africa's political parties have been holding their final rallies ahead of Wednesday's general election. Also in this podcast, we head to a Japanese auction house. And we find out why people would buy a piece of fruit that costs as much as a half-decent car. We begin in Ukraine. Russian airstrikes hit a busy DIY superstore in the city of Kharkiv on Saturday, killing at least six people and injuring many others. President Volodymyr Zelensky said it was thought more than 200 people were inside the complex at the time. Firefighters had to tackle intense flames. A column of thick black smoke was seen rising over the site. Local officials said there was no military facility nearby. Mr. Zelensky denounced the airstrikes.
The attack on Kharkiv is yet another demonstration of Russian madness. It is not possible to call it anything else. It is only someone crazy like Putin that is capable of killing and terrorizing people in such a mean way.
Our international editor Jeremy Bowen sent this report from the scene.
I've just been talking to the mayor. He said this happened about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a DIY superstore. An obvious place, you'd think, for civilians to go on a Saturday afternoon. One of the strange incongruities of the war is that, in a way, a modicum of normal life does go on while the war continues. So people were out doing what they had to do when this place was hit, they say, by two Russian glide bombs. Now, this will underline the anxiety that Ukrainians feel about not having suitable air defences. President Zelensky has said so repeatedly, and he said so again now after this, that Ukraine needs to be able to defend itself. And of course, it relies upon its Western allies for doing all of that. From the Russian point of view, this is another sign of their growing strength and the way in which they're taking advantage of what appears to be a window of opportunity for them to up their military effort while Ukraine waits for the kind of reinforcements of weapons and ammunition that it wants from its allies, which have been held up, particularly in the United States, and also while the Ukrainians train more troops. There's a manpower shortage too. So this, quite frankly, at the moment, is for the Ukrainians one of the most anxious periods since those first months after the full-scale invasion more than 2 years ago.
Jeremy Bowen in Kharkiv. G7 finance ministers say they've made progress on plans to use profits from frozen Russian assets to help Ukraine's war effort. It's thought some of the billions of dollars belonging to Russia would be used as collateral for a $50 billion loan to Kyiv. Speaking at a meeting in northern Italy, the US Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, said there was broad-based support for the idea. But she and her Italian counterpart, Giancarlo Giorgetti, acknowledged that more work needed to be done ahead of a meeting of G7 leaders next month. I heard more from our world business reporter, David Waddell.
The EU's reluctant to dip into the capital assets. It's concerned about the unpredictable legal implications of doing that. Now, those implications are becoming clearer. Just as the EU and other Western jurisdictions hold Russian assets, so too does Russia hold European assets. Russia regards this proposal as akin to state-level theft. Here's the Russian finance minister, Anton Siluanov.
It always seemed that the property of other countries, including the gold and foreign exchange reserves of central banks, was a taboo that no sanctions applied to. Now the ideology has changed. We have frozen money in EU accounts. We have assets. We also get income. If there is a decision, we will act in a similar manner. We will respond in kind. So we have an answer.
So, David, Russia clearly very much opposed to this. The proposal could go through within the next few months. And there is a lot of urgency, isn't there, at the moment?
Well, there is. The war has been going on now, as of Friday, for 2 years and 3 months. That's 27 months. And Ukraine has managed to push back Russian advances quite successfully in the early months, but it's struggling a lot more now than it was earlier. The widespread expectation is that earlier sanctions would have caused Russia more trouble than they have, but it hasn't worked out that way. And China and India have been criticised by Western nations for supporting Russia's war economy. Ukraine needs the money to push back, but there's also concern about the upcoming US presidential election, that if Donald Trump wins that, then it may be more difficult to pass this kind of measure in future.
David Waddell. Israel is reported to have agreed on a new framework to revive stalled negotiations aimed at securing a hostage deal in Gaza. Israeli media say the agreement follows meetings in Paris between Israel's intelligence chief, the head of America's CIA, and the Prime Minister of Qatar. Mediated talks ground to a halt early this month after Israel launched a military operation in Rafah. Meanwhile, after 7.5 months of the war in Gaza, the question of humanitarian aid remains a huge problem. Aid agencies say not enough is getting in. Israel says it's doing what it can to improve the flow. But there have also been protesters trying to stop aid reaching the enclave, mainly at the Kerem Shalom crossing, by increasingly targeting aid convoys coming from Jordan. Now, Israeli peace activists have started to organise patrols to make sure the aid convoys get through unscathed. Our correspondent Paul Adams reports.
This is the Tarkumia crossing point between the West Bank, just up the hill here, and Israel. Any aid that is coming from Jordan has to come through the West Bank, through this checkpoint, before it heads down to Gaza. And a week ago, this was where aid trucks were set upon by right-wing Israeli activists.
But today, volunteers from the group Standing Together are here in bright purple vests. Souf Patishi is one of the group's founding members.
People in Gaza are starving, and aid should get to Gaza. And if the aid is stopping here because of this extremist, we must be here to make sure that the aid will get into Gaza. The Israeli society should say in a loud and clear voice that we are opposed to these acts.
Souf's group brings together Jews and Arabs from all over the country, including Nasser, a Palestinian Israeli from Haifa.
I feel very empowered. All these 7-8 months of war and the killing of Gazans. Now, finally, I have something to do to help these people that are starving.
The truck drivers toot their horns in gratitude. The presence of peace activists, they hope, providing some badly needed security. A handful of right-wing protesters show up, and soon the roundabout outside the checkpoint is the scene of heated argument. Off to one side, two young women who don't want to be identified explain why they feel they need to be here. Both believe the aid is mostly stolen by Hamas, helping to perpetuate the war.
We would prefer that we didn't have to do the blockages. Honestly, I don't like ransacking things. It's not one of my favorite hobbies. But we'd prefer that to the death of our friends and family, which is what happens as the longer that this war drags on.
I think it's time to stop caring what everybody else thinks and do what's necessary to protect my life, to protect my family.
The police are here at Tarkumia today, keeping an eye on both sets of activists. The police have been accused of failing to prevent settler violence. Some say this is no accident. Their ultimate boss, the National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, is one of the most hardline members of Benjamin Netanyahu's government, a vocal supporter of the settlers and an opponent of sending any aid into Gaza. Souf Patishi says he and his colleagues are here to shame the police into action.
Whenever we're getting to a place and see that the extremists are here, we call the police to encourage them to come to the area. Second, a lot of time the police were in the areas when attacked occurred, but they didn't have someone to push them to act. And it's very sad because the police should keep the law.
Today, it's Souf and his colleagues from Standing Together who win this battle of wills. The trucks pass by safely, bound for Gaza. But the attacks haven't stopped. In at least two cases inside the West Bank, Palestinian lorry drivers who had nothing to do with transporting aid were attacked and hospitalised. Just one more way in which this conflict seems to touch everyone.
That report by Paul Adams. Police in India say more than 20 people have died in a massive fire at an entertainment complex in Gujarat. The Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, a former chief minister of Gujarat, has praised rescuers. Here's Electra Naismith.
The blaze broke out at the gaming zone in Rajkot on Saturday afternoon when the mall was packed with children and young people. Flames and black smoke could be seen billowing into the sky before the fire was eventually brought under control. Rescue teams managed to save many people. They've been taken to local hospitals, but it's feared the number of dead will rise as rescuers search through the building's wreckage, trying to retrieve as many bodies as possible. Police say both the owner and manager of the gaming zone are among several detained in connection with the fire.
Electra Naismith. It is a common worry for parents around the world over whether to give children a mobile phone and how much screen time they should have. Research in the UK estimates that around a quarter of children aged 5 to 7 years old now have their own smartphone. But in the US, there's been a rise in popularity for mobile phones that are somewhat less smart, so-called dumb phones. They just have basic features for calls and texts, with some parents turning to these models for children instead. So, is a new market emerging in phones geared towards children? Our Los Angeles correspondent, Emma Vardy, reports.
I'm just on my phone here and I've just looked up in the settings how much I am using this device, and I'm ashamed to say it tells me I'm on my phone for an average of 7 hours and 34 minutes a day. Wow, that is pretty bad really when you think about it. So it's no wonder that so many parents not only worry about their own phone habits but also about getting children a smartphone and how to manage that. But there is help out there. There's this new trend towards the opposite of smartphones and back towards the kind of phones that we all used in the past, now known as a dumb phone.
This feels like a brick. I love it. And it's got this huge speaker on the back, right? Mm-hmm,
so you can rock out.
Yeah.
And Daisy Quigbaum and Will Stultz are co-founders of Dumb Wireless in Los Angeles. And they're helping customers break away from the addictive nature of smartphone apps by selling various models of dumb phones.
We get all sorts of phone calls because we take calls all throughout the day on our personal numbers. And sometimes even men call and say, I'm addicted to explicit content. How can I get a phone that'll stop me from that? And we'll talk to them. We'll talk to anybody. But we also have a lot of parents looking to get their kid that first phone and they want to talk to them, but they don't want them just drifting off on the internet. So we have a lot of parents and also, you know, people in their 20s and 30s that want to make a lifestyle change.
They also sell a tool which can instantly turn your smartphone into a simpler device, blocking the apps that can lead to hours of mindless scrolling.
The parent can control the smartphone with this physical tag and kind of hold the lock on it and also monitor the usage of what's going on with their kid.
I don't think that kids are interested in phones that are meant for kids. So if it's marketed toward kids or if it looks like it's for a kid, I think that someone's going to outgrow it really quickly.
The big phone companies do offer apps and products to monitor and restrict children on their devices. But research suggests often rules aren't enforced or children are more tech savvy than their parents. And many adults, too, are increasingly conscious that their own screen time is out of control.
This may look like a smartphone, but it's not. It's so much better.
tech list have designed a sleek device that looks much like an iPhone. But the Wise Phone only has a camera, clock, calculator, maps and music, and some limited third-party tools like Uber. But founder Chris Casper says it's intentionally boring.
You turn it on and it has 9 apps and there's no app icons. It's just words like the word phone, the word messaging, the word maps. We're asking this critical question, what's actually good for us? And that's what we're putting on our phone instead of just anything and everything that might be convenient for us, but it's actually sucking the life out of us.
The phone was made with children in mind.
I had 10 and 13-year-old foster daughters, and they weren't trustworthy with the phone. So we made it safe for kids. But if you have a phone that's branded as a kid's device, there's some shame associated with that. And so we made a very adult, sophisticated, Apple-esque, really nice device.
So could new, simpler devices really become a healthier way forward for children and teenagers?
My school did not have any rules on phones.
Luke got his first smartphone aged 14.
Instantly, I was like, I got Instagram, I got social, and it just kind of, it was a downward spiral. I was kind of trapped in for a sense.
Now, age 16, and with an important period in his studies coming up, much to the amusement of friends, Luke himself decided to swap his smartphone for a simpler device.
They think it's pretty weird, but at this point, I'm like, you know what? It doesn't really matter because it's helped me so much, and it's definitely took me into a better spot in my life right now.
But as sensible as that sounds, not every teenager would be as enthusiastic about giving up their smartphone.
Emma Vardy. Still to come.
My right hand is reasonably functional. It's very distorted, but I have a bit of grip and strength in it. But my left hand is fairly useless. And my hope was that my left thumb would start working a bit.
We hear from someone with profound paralysis who has been given new treatment to help her regain movement.
A $6 billion con.
It didn't take long for it to spread like wildfire.
You got to take a look at this really crazy gold stock. A buddy of mine got in at a dime.
Which destroyed lives and devastated communities.
Every little town across the nation, people have shares in this.
We lost everything.
And to date, no one has been brought to justice.
Somebody knows more than we know.
The $6 billion gold scam. From the BBC World Service and CBC. Search for the $6 billion gold scam wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast. Next to South Africa, where 30 years after the first multiracial elections, many people are questioning whether the Rainbow Nation has lost its luster. High unemployment, violent crime and crumbling infrastructure were the less than inspiring backdrop to Saturday's final campaign rallies that took place ahead of elections this week. Our senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy reports from the party's rally in Johannesburg.
There's a lot of excitement here at the FNB Stadium. Supporters of the African National Congress dressed in their party's colours, yellow, green and black, dancing and singing. They have been bussed in from different parts of the country to come and show support to the Liberation Party.
I'm so blissful. There is nothing that I pledge like to be here. I'm here to support our ANC. We are happy, we are supporting our president.
Do you think ANC still has the solution for this country?
Yes, yes, we are the only solution. The other ones are not the solution. They're just the cause of our problems here.
It's still the most popular party in South Africa. But gone are the days it's enjoyed more than 70% popularity. This time round, there are fears it might struggle to get the 50% it needs to continue governing on its own. It might be forced to look for coalitions.
Over the next 5 years, working with all South Africans, we will implement a jobs plan.
The president, Cyril Ramaphosa, whose administration has overseen South Africa's economic decline, is promising better times ahead.
To put more South Africans to work, we will build our industries and invest in an inclusive economy. We will tackle the high cost of living.
The president ended his speech with a call to free Palestine. his government has taken Israel to the International Court of Justice, which has ordered a halt to the offensive in Gaza. South Africans are more concerned about the lack of jobs, staggering inequality, and runaway violent crime. Opposition rallies are also happening this weekend, and voters have 50-odd parties to choose from come Wednesday.
Anne Soy in Johannesburg. Earlier this week, the BBC featured news of a new treatment to help people with profound paralysis regain more movement. It involves using electrodes around the affected area of the spine, passing high-frequency pulses through them and combining that with concentrated physiotherapy. Clinical trials on 60 patients who have been living with spinal injuries for years found that nearly three-quarters of them showed some improvement. The journalist Melanie Reed took part in the trial. She's lived with a spinal cord injury for 15 years after breaking her neck and back in a horse riding accident. She spoke to Rebecca Kesby.
My right hand is reasonably functional. It's very distorted, but I have a bit of grip and strength in it. But my left hand is fairly useless. And my hope was that my left thumb would start working a bit, because if you're able-bodied, you never think about it, but your thumbs are incredibly important to grip anything. And so I went into the therapy with a very open mind. Certainly, I improved the function on the thumb. I can now do a number of little tasks with it, and the hand is stronger and more supple than it used to be.
That's amazing, and that's a difference that has lasted since ending the therapy. This is quite a long time after you took part in this trial.
Yes, the device wakens up the nerve connections. I think you get a lot of physical therapy with it. I think all these things work together. But the device, when you have it on your neck buzzing away, there is definitely increased strength in your hand. I mean, I remember one experiment where we had a bowl of water in front of us and we had to wring out a face cloth with our hands. I mean, I couldn't get much water out of it when my hands were without the device on. But when the device was switched on, I could squeeze an awful lot more water out.
I mean, that must have been quite an emotional experience for you, I should think. You said it's difficult to imagine how little movements mean such a big deal, but anyone who's ever cut themselves with a vegetable knife will know, you know, just how a tiny injury in your hand makes a huge difference, doesn't it?
Again, if you're able-bodied, you have no concept of how vital your hands are. And for the able-bodied, paralysis is all about being able to walk again. But if you have a higher level injury, if your neck is broken, all you really want to do is be able to use your hands again. I'm lucky, my right hand is fairly functional. But if you imagine you couldn't use your hands to feed yourself or to scratch your own nose. And my hope is that this device, if it's employed early on in clinical settings, will help reawake plasticity so that people will be able to do that. People who wouldn't have that function. It's the science of tiny gains, and tiny gains are life-changing in spinal injury.
You mentioned this thing buzzing on your neck. Just briefly tell us how you were sort of affected during the treatment. Is it something that you could have been mobile in your chair, going about your daily business with this thing going?
In the research setting, no. I mean, it was quite intense. The device was buzzing on your neck. It felt internally noisy. Of course, I was using a prototype as well, but it was tiring. I mean, at the end of the hour-long session, I was fairly whacked.
When you're facing the kind of situation you have been over the years, I guess there is always that hope that there may be some sort of scientific breakthrough. But at the same time, it's a case, I guess, I mean, perhaps you can tell us, of learning to live a new life.
Yes. You know, you do get a bit cynical after a few years in the chair. When it first happens, you think, oh, in 5 years' time, maybe there'll be a cure. And after nearly 15 years, I'm fairly cynical. I know there are no miracles. But I believe that with this move forward, little gains, we are moving towards a brighter future.
The journalist Melanie Reed. The Iranian director, Mohammad Rasoulof, was given a standing ovation on Saturday evening at the Cannes Film Festival as he received a special award for his film The Seed of the Sacred Fig. Rasoulof made his way to France from Iran, where he was facing an 8-year prison sentence for making his new film. He told the audience at the Cannes winners' ceremony that his fellow citizens had been taken hostage by the Iranian regime. So, a distinctly political note on the Cannes Festival's last day. I spoke to our arts journalist, Vincent Dowd.
Of course, Cannes is famous for its glamour, beautiful people, frocks and bow ties along the sunny Croisette, but there is a real world out there too. Mohamed Razalouf, who's 51, is well known for films such as There Is No Evil. For well over a decade, he's been distinctly unpopular with the authorities in Tehran. He's already been imprisoned for his work, which does not toe the government line. The Seed of the Sacred Fig is about an investigating judge in Tehran. It was already out of favour with those in power anyway, who were made even more unhappy to hear it was going to be seen at the world's most important film festival, which I think came as news to them. The director was told to withdraw it from Cannes, sentenced to a long jail sentence and flogging, indeed. In fact, he then defied a travel ban to come to Cannes. We don't know entirely how he got out of Iran, and he's been greeted with a special prize, as you see. It seems highly unlikely he'll be able to return home, well, perhaps ever.
And Vincent, a lot of attention too for the film Emilia Perez from the French director Jacques Audiard, mainly for its cast.
That's right. The Argentinian trans actor Carla Sofia Gascon plays a violent cartel leader in Mexico, married to Jesse, who's played by Selena Gomez. These two performers, plus Adriana Paz and Zoe Saldana, have jointly, all four of them, been awarded the Best Actress Award for what some have called a comedy thriller musical. Well, even disregarding that rather strange genre, even a quarter of an award for a trans performer, I think, is definitely a turning point.
We should talk about the top prize, the Palme d'Or. It went to an American comedy drama about a sex worker in New York called Honora. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, it's the first US winner for 13 years. America does not always do well down in the south of France. Honora is the central character in a powerful tragic comedy, shall we say, made by Sean Baker, who had a hit, you may remember, a few years ago with Red Rocket. It's that rare thing at Cannes, in my experience, a film pretty well everybody loved. Clearly the judges, led this year by Barbie director Greta Gerwig, had no doubts. Honora, to go into the story briefly, is a stripper and sex worker who becomes involved with a handsome, wealthy young Russian in America. He's played by Mark Edelstein, who's being lauded now as the Russian Timothy Chalamet, if you can imagine such a thing. The father of his character in the film is furious when the two young people marry in Las Vegas. Sean Baker said he knew a story which is at times violent and sad also needed to contain humor.
I always think that humor is necessary in human stories because it's part of our lives. You know, we all use humor to cope, humor to get by. And I can't stand when I see a film devoid of humor or a story that's devoid of humor because this is not real. And I guess the challenge is balancing that. When you want to tell a story that is ultimately tragic, how much do you infuse humor and where? And I just feel that without humor, it's not real.
The director, Sean Baker, ending that report by Vincent Dowd. The American songwriter Richard Sherman has died at the age of 95. Working with his late brother Robert, Richard Sherman wrote the songs for some of Walt Disney's biggest musicals. Claire Runacres looks back at his career.
Richard Sherman and his older brother Robert had their first hits writing for pop acts like Johnny Burnett in 1960. Walt Disney decided their energy would transfer to the movies, and the Shermans became Disney's staff writers. They supplied bright numbers, mixing sentiment and humour for many hit films, including Mary Poppins. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Later, when Walt Disney died, they brought jazz to Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. I want to be like you. And when, in Britain, Cubby Broccoli set out to make a family musical, the choice of writers was obvious, adding another classic to their songwriting legacy.
Claire Runacres reporting there. Now, to the final of the oldest club competition in world football, the FA Cup. The first final took place in 1871. There have been many intense matches since then, but ranking high amongst them will almost certainly be Saturday's game that pitted Manchester City against Manchester United. And it was the underdogs, United, who came out on top, 2-1. I spoke to the BBC's Lee James, who was watching the match at Wembley Stadium.
It was Manchester United who did hold on to lift the FA Cup trophy for the 13th time in their history. They were the underdogs coming into this final. Manchester City, having wrapped up their fourth successive Premier League title, they were looking to make history with back-to-back domestic league and cup doubles. It was also a beleaguered manager, Erik ten Hag, who led his Manchester United team today, growing a rumour that he would be dismissed no matter what the result today. But it was United who had the better game plan. They were resilient and they crucially scored the two goals in the first half that really set up this victory. A very fine first half display. There was a mix-up between the City goalkeeper, Stefan Ortega, and Josko Guardiol, and it allowed Alejandro Garnacho to open the scoring. And then from a lovely move that swept across the pitch from Bruno Fernandes' touch, Kobbie Mainoo scored the goal 9 minutes later. United two up at half-time. City did push in the second half. They did have opportunities as well, but Erling Haaland crashed his shot against the crossbar. Kyle Walker's effort was saved by Andre Onana, the Cameroon international goalkeeper. Julian Alvarez wasted opportunities as well. There was a late goal for City. Jeremy Doku pulling one back with just 4 minutes left. Manchester United were not to be denied.
It had been a very torrid season by Manchester United's high standards. How important is this for them?
Well, I think for Manchester United, it was vital that they had some silver lining to what has been a very disappointing season, finishing in eighth place in the Premier League. It means there will be European football for the team next season. And for their manager, Erik ten Hag, well, will he depart after 2 years and two trophies after they lifted the League Cup last season, or will there be an opportunity to lift Manchester United? So Jim Ratcliffe, who will make that decision, has said it's a glorious feeling to win the Cup. He's not commented on his manager, though, but talks about the team's total commitment and skill that overcame one of the great teams in football. We watch this space to see what the future holds for Erik ten Hag, but it's Manchester United, Nick, that have won the FA Cup here at Wembley today.
Lee James. It's known as the world's most expensive fruit. Grown in Japan, a pair of Yubari melons has sold for 3 million yen. That's around $19,000. Alice Adley has more.
The first Yubari King Melon auction of the year has become an annual tradition in the Sapporo City's central wholesale market. The buyer was Hokuyu Pack Company, a melon packaging and sales company in Yubari in Hokkaido. They've been the top bidder for the third consecutive year. The firm's president, Noda Kiyomichi, said this year's fruit were rich in flavour and he was happy to have acquired the two melons, which are perfectly round and have a delicate orange flesh.
I know how hard farmers worked for the melons. I wanted to keep the price over 3 million yen to maintain their value.
So why are they so highly prized? Aficionados say it's like eating sweet melon-flavoured honey. Before awarding the fruit the Yubari label, inspectors tap and flick it to listen for a low, deep sound, smell it for a sweet fragrance and inspect the rind. More than 3,000 tonnes of the melons grown by more than 80 farmers are expected to be produced this year, with sales worth around 2 billion yen or $12 million. The highest price ever paid for a pair of the melons at auction was 5 million yen in 2019. The fruit joins Wagyu beef, beluga caviar and Italian and French truffles in taking luxury to new heights.
Alice Adderley reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Ablakwa. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.
A $6 billion con.
It didn't take long for it to spread like wildfire.
You got to take a look at this really crazy gold stock. A buddy of mine got in at a dime.
Which destroyed lives and devastated communities.
Every little town across the nation, people have shares in this.
We lost everything.
And to date, no one has been brought to justice.
Somebody knows more than we know.
The $6 billion gold scam. From the BBC World Service and CBC. Search for the $6 billion gold scam wherever you get your podcasts.